And now we have another panel that we've never done before, but we're really looking forward to, the international baseball landscape. And this is very appropriate, especially with Major League Baseball opening in Australia, you know, next week. And we're fortunate to have Josh Rawich here from the Diamondbacks, who will be leaving tomorrow on this trip. So it's a very timely panel as well. And I will let Rob Nyer introduce everybody else. But first, I just wanted to introduce Rob, who's been with us throughout, you know, the 3 years of the conference. Rob's now the senior baseball editor at FoxSports.com. Rob joined Fox Sports just recently as their senior baseball editor after serving as national baseball editor at SB Nation for 3 years. Prior to that, Rob spent 15 years covering Major League Baseball as a columnist at ESPN.com. He began his career as a research assistant for Bill James and later worked for Stats, Inc., and I'll introduce Rob Nyer.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks, Vince Gennaro. I think you're out there somewhere for inviting me again this year. This is my, as Mark said, my third conference, and I've been a Sabre member since, I believe, 1985, maybe 86, and between working for Bill James and being a part of Sabre for almost 30 years, it's been a great ride, and I couldn't have done what I've done without Sabre. So if there aren't any non-members in here, I don't know if that's even allowed, but if there are, you should really join, because you're not going to find a better place. And I want to thank them, too, for inviting me to moderate this panel, because when he first asked me, when Mark asked me, I said, why me? This is not my area of expertise, but then I thought maybe I'm the perfect guy because I have lots of questions. So I hope that shows. On the far right, our panelists, Leo Landino works for ESPN Deporte. Leo's a native of Venezuela, which is a hotbed of baseball talent. Not true when I was a kid. There were a few Venezuelans in the majors when I was growing up, but it's really turned into something big. And I don't really know anything. I don't know why that happened. I'd like to talk to you sometime about that. I don't think that it might be beyond the scope of this panel to try to figure out why some countries develop more baseball talent than others, but it's certainly a fascinating subject, especially when you look at the countries that don't yet but might someday. Tyrone Brooks, in the middle, director of player personnel for the Pirates, oversees all the pro scouting and the non-Latin international scouting. Tyrone is, I hope you probably have his bio with you, but I'm in particular fascinated by the fact that 5 years ago, Tyrone created the Baseball Industry Network, which is a network of baseball professionals, anybody in baseball. Tyrone just told me that there are now more than 22,000 members. Just a great resource if you want to basically meet, contact anybody in the game.
Got any members out there?
All right, there you go.
Okay, got a few.
And Josh Rawich, who is not in your program. Josh is filling in for Craig Shipley, who was taken away by his duties in Australia with the Diamondbacks trip. Josh, this is his 20th year in baseball, third year with the Diamondbacks. He is the senior VP, of communications. Josh was also a writer for 2 years, covering, I think, the Dodgers. Did you cover the Dodgers?
With Dodgers and the Giants, yeah.
MLB.com. I will say on a personal note, a lot of PR people have been very kind to me over the last few years when I come to spring training. Josh has been unbelievably kind, and I'm very grateful to Josh. So let's kick this off. These guys will talk for 35, 45 minutes, and then we'll take some questions. I want to start with a question about the World Baseball Classic. Every time it comes around, there are at least a few writers in the States who sort of wonder what all the fuss is about, say, why can't they sell out the ballparks? Is this even worth it? Why does baseball do this? It disrupts spring training. Some of the players don't participate. But there is a greater strategy there, and I think I'd like you guys to talk about what the WBC means for baseball outside of the United States. And Josh, you could start us off, because you've been there.
Sure, yeah. We've been involved I've been in all three of them, and I don't think that the goal of the WBC is to teach the U.S. about baseball abroad. I mean, really what it is to capture the emotion and excitement in other countries. And if you've seen baseball, if any of you have been over to any of the other countries that are playing, you can tell this is the biggest thing that goes on in a number of countries. I mean, Leo can certainly speak to it in his home country, but I mean, it is, I think maybe we were a little bit myopic in that way, that we seem to think that baseball does revolve around the U.S. Obviously, this is where it's played the most and at the highest level. But I think we're failing to see the larger goal, which is countries like Italy, who wound up kind of surprising everybody last year. And you go from a niche sport to being on the news every single night for about a two-week period in Italy, and suddenly you have little kids who are seeing baseball for the first time, and they're wanting to play, and they're hearing about it, and the ability that it has to spread that quickly when you have an aspiration to play for your national team someday is invaluable.
Josh, is anyone tracking youth participation in some of these countries to see if that's changed?
Yeah, it definitely is. And the only place where I know I can cite a number from is we actually just went, when we went to Australia in November, we stopped in New Zealand, and they basically said that just in the last 3 or 4 years, when they've kind of gone from a really, really tiny sport to making a push for it, they went from, I believe it was, they said 900 participants to 6,000 participants at the youth level. And now it's just, I mean, it doesn't sound like a lot, but in a country like
this. Did you say in New Zealand?
In New Zealand,
6,000 kids playing baseball?
Yeah, absolutely. And their national team is the Diamondbacks, which is why we decided to stop in there and host a clinic. but it's now, I mean, we've actually got a meeting coming up with the New Zealand national, with actually several high-level members of the government when we go to Sydney next week to talk about how we can grow the sport out there. And that's just one tiny example. I'm sure in every one of these countries, when you put the focus for that long a period of time, it's gonna grow the youth.
I mean, definitely somebody having a chance to cover, you know, from the very beginning, covering the actual World Baseball Classic, just seeing that excitement, you know, with all the fans and just the thrill that they have when you're at the various parks and various sites. I mean, it's pretty incredible. Just as somebody who obviously, you know, has lived in the States, but also just seeing all the excitement in these various countries, and especially, you know, last year, like when you're there in San Francisco and you see all the different contingent of people coming and just being so supportive of their particular country and the players, and just really trying to put on a great show for everybody internationally.
Leo, does that had an impact on participation in the places that you've been?
Well, let me start with saying that if you guys haven't embraced the World Baseball Classic, you don't know what you're missing. Like, you really don't know what you're missing. Like, in other countries, like Josh was saying, in Latin America, in Europe, this is a national matter. This is like a real serious business. Like, it goes over the top, like governments, sports ministries around the world are really, really, really into it. So that's why players are very willing to participate, because it's part of they're representing the country, is the proud of, you know, the pride of representing the country is really, really important. Especially for places like, I would say, Venezuela, Dominican Republic, Mexico, Cuba, Italy, last World Baseball Classic, what the Netherlands did was amazing. The growth of baseball in Netherlands has been pretty much documented over the World Baseball Classics, and you can see like kids in the Netherlands and in other Netherlands countries, yeah, like Curacao, Aruba, the Netherlands Antilles. So people want to play with their country. Players are willing to leave the MLB teams for that. I would say with the World Baseball Classic, the biggest setback it has is the owners are still being reluctant to let players to fully perform in the World Baseball Classic. And the baseball as a game, the only problem with World Baseball Classic is that there's a lot of limitations. I mean, it's natural that they have limitations, pitching limitations and all these rules, but it really affects the level of the game, and it is really affecting I would say how the owners are approaching World Baseball Classic is really affecting the natural development of the tournament. People compare these to the World Cup in soccer. So you don't go to players don't go to Brazil, for example, to represent Argentina or Italy or some other countries without any limitations, because the FIFA, which is the soccer world organization, goes over the leagues. In this case, MLB goes over the World Baseball Classic, or goes over pretty much everything. So, of course, Major League Baseball is the biggest and most powerful baseball entity in the world, but the owners agreed to start World Baseball Classic. But at the same time, when the moment comes to allow a player to go, I mean, that's where the problem is coming. And I think in upcoming years we're going to start seeing an improvement in this area.
So speaking of the owners, it seems that on a practical level, participating in the Olympics is almost impossible because of the scheduling issues. But does the WBC accomplish everything essentially that being in the Olympics would? I mean, is there any practical reason to even want to be in the Olympics?
I mean, we certainly now, I think that the WBC will wind up far surpassing what baseball in the Olympics ever was, and may have already gotten to that point. So, I mean, it really isn't ever practical to stop our season and send our best players, and it's not the Olympics if you're not sending your best players. Right. So, I mean, sending a group of amateurs is probably not the best way to do it either. I actually think one of the best things that's happened to the WBC is that the U.S. hasn't won, and it's actually kind of made we hosted Team USA last year at Salt River Fields, and I mean, Joe Torre and these guys, they were, this is going to be our year. We're sick of getting our butts kicked by everybody else. And I mean, I can actually say that the single best sporting event I have ever been to, as may surprise people, was the 2009 finals between Japan and Korea at Dodger Stadium. I have never seen a building like that. It was mind-blowing, and that was Darvish pitching, and you got to believe that when Darvish or Tanaka, these guys get on that stage and face the top possible talent in the world, that helps scouts. I mean, you can speak to that. Now they've seen them pitch against major league talent, not just against the talent in their home countries.
Tyrone, this question start with you. How do you know when a country's baseball environment is developed well enough to begin scouting?
You know, as far as that, I mean, you know, MLB has done a great job of reaching out to the various countries and trying to get programs established, you know, bringing over a lot of different players coming over through MLB International. I mean, they've tried a tremendous and done a great job thus far in doing that. Once you get an opportunity to really start seeing some fruits of a few players actually starting to have the opportunity to get signed, I mean, that really starts to open up the eyes of everybody and throughout the whole entire industry at that point. But you still need the whole matter of the fan base of the people there in that particular country having, you know, a passion for or following the game, you know, having games being broadcast on television. I think that all plays a big role in how you can have that as far as having a country develop to that point. I think we're going to see some places, you know, there's been a lot of different things done recently in the last few years, even in China. Right now, MLB teams cannot sign players out of there, but still there is a lot of outreach going on with MLB International, a lot of players going over. They do have an MLB Academy over there now as well. And just right now, they're in the process of trying to open that particular market up just because there's so many people there.
So last year, there were, on opening day, 28% of the players in the majors were born outside the U.S. And that's basically, that figure's held steady. Tyrone, can you throw out a guess? What's the next country we're going to see a player come from that we haven't before?
Well, really good question. I mean, I think definitely China at some point is really going to, at some point, going to have something as far as having players coming out of there. Just from, there's so many people there. And obviously, as far as having people that are athletic, that's the whole big thing, is having somebody who's athletic, and then if we can help them transfer that athleticism to the skills that are related to our game. And being you have a country that big, and obviously they already have showed they have a huge passion for basketball, what was done with different things, and you know, Yao Ming, especially what he did as far as the NBA and things like that, but you're going to have a situation at some point where I think that area is going to really open up.
Are we talking about 10 years, 15 years until we have a Chinese player in professional baseball? What do you think?
I would say within the next few years, within the next probably 2 to 3 years easily. Wow. Because there are some players over there even now at this point. But the market hasn't been opened up. MLB has not fully opened it up to allow teams to really go in to do much.
Leo, what about you?
I would say in a short term is Colombia. Definitely Colombia is the next baseball frontier. I mean, on a really short term. 20 years ago, there were 10 signed players in professional baseball. Right now, they have over 100. Colombia has developed in 10 years, in 15 years, with a huge help from Edgar Renteria and his family, and a huge private investment in the coast of in the Pacific coast of Colombia. They have developed a fully operational league. They played the World Baseball Classic qualifiers. They have brought up MLB caliber players, Julio Teran, Jose Quintana for the White Sox. And they're going to keep coming. The amount of players that are being, it's kind of easier to scout Colombia than to scout other areas, just because it's closer to Venezuela. Scouts in the border areas can just drive 3-4 hours to look for a player and to see a player. And sometimes even scouts in Colombia are bringing players to tryouts in Venezuela. So that is making easier that transition. And the other country is Brazil. Like we're seeing.
We've not had a Brazilian major leaguer.
Yeah,
we have. Yeah, we have actually two now. Jan Gomez, when he came up with the big leagues, but Jan Gomez was pretty much brought up. He grew up in Brazil, and then he learned and played college baseball here in the States, and then he was drafted. So for international baseball purposes, that doesn't really count. However, Andre Rienzo, pitcher for the White Sox, really, it's a fully developed player in Brazil. That's a huge step.
And there are more coming from Brazil, you think?
We just signed our first Brazilian prospect about 3 weeks ago. I know a lot of teams are starting to put scouts down there more full-time. Baseball just had a showcase down there last month or 2 months ago. No, it was in November. It's coming. It's definitely coming.
And they're coming from the Japanese school. I mean, in most of the baseball movement in Brazil is happening in Sao Paulo. And in that area, there's a heavy Japanese colony for over 100 years. So they are learning the game the Japanese way. Most of the coaches and instructors from Little League and their baseball instructors are Japanese descendants, and they play the game the Japanese way, which is really, really interesting.
I mean, obviously, one of the great things about the international players, they do bring different flavors of baseball to the States, and I mean, that goes without saying, but this is an analytics conference. Can we touch on that for a second, Leo? What role does statistical analysis play when you're scouting or developing players in Latin America?
At this point, statistical analysis, which is a great topic for the analytics conference, is pretty much zero at the level of scouting. However, it's been really interesting how sabermetrics and statistical analysis has been increasingly used in, especially in Venezuela and the Dominican Republic in the last, I would say, 3 years. Teams are being more aware of the tools they have available, and management is changing at the front office levels. Some of the teams, there are 6 teams in the Dominican Republic, 8 teams in Venezuela, and I would say at this point 80% of them are using statistical analysis. It's not as deep as we can see on a major league clubhouse or on a major league front office. But once the season starts and they are getting more and more up-to-date data from their own league, stats are being more representative, and they're becoming a better tool. Although in winter baseball plays a lot of the momentum of the player and other circumstances, like you know, like if you are an American guy playing in Dominican Republic, you know that it, even though you might you know you might not having a great week just because you know you ate something and something went wrong or something like that, or you drank water and the water you know got food poisoned or whatever, like. Things are that nature that really happening in winter baseball, but it's increasingly being used more and more. Teams are looking for more programs and more ways to utilize stats to take decisions in the front office, and old school executives are being more that were once I would say 5 years ago were really reluctant to look at stats. Are really more into it. So I think it's a great advancement for winter baseball. It's a great advancement for player development in MLB because you have more stats to play with, and MLB teams are appreciated for all that.
Tyrone, do you see a role for analytics in international scouting at all?
I think definitely. I mean, you look at from an international standpoint as far as now with, I mean, there's a lot of data that's available, especially in you know Japan and Korea and those professional leagues. There's information you can get, which is very helpful as far as just trying to look, and also you're trying to establish, kind of looking at a baseline from what you can see from what's happening with certain players, or you know, you're looking at a Darvish and what he did in Japan, and now you're trying to see how things might translate as far as how that when he comes over to the States and obviously comes and performs with the Rangers, just trying to get an idea, seeing how these guys are actually, you know, how those everything they're doing is transferring over. So it definitely plays a role, and we're there's a lot of different, a few different companies also that are providing data and other analysis that we can, each team has the possibility to get access to, one including Scout Dragon, which has contracts with various teams. They're also in the process of talking with other teams, and they do provide data and can kind of give you little snippets of things that you want and can kind of customize that information for a team as well if they have certain parameters they have in place with their own system. So it definitely plays a role in how you can go about that process of trying to find the little nuances there amongst each player.
Josh, I want you to address the – we could talk about this probably for another the rest of the panel, but the language issue. I think typically it's been discussed learning English has been talked about as a way for the Latino players to adjust to professional baseball in the U.S., but, you know, thinking back to Vince Gennaro's talk yesterday about chemistry, I would think it's good for team chemistry if everybody can communicate. Can you talk a little bit about what's done these days in terms of educating Latino players? And I'll also throw this in there, too, and maybe and anybody could address this. Why not teach U.S.-born players to speak Spanish?
That's where I was going to take your question first.
While they're in the minors.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take that piece first, actually. For anybody who's out there who's looking to break into sports, I will tell you, when I was an 18-year-old intern, a gentleman at the Dodgers told me to go learn Spanish, and I'm sure he told a bunch of people to do that, but I actually listened to him, and I cannot tell you how valuable it has been in my career to be able to speak to reporters, speak to players, just dealing with a number of issues. If you can speak Spanish, you are automatically four steps ahead of everybody else that you're dealing with in baseball. So for those of you that think that may be what you want to get into, I would highly recommend it. I think there's value in it. I think a lot of the English American players will learn it naturally, just if they have to want to learn it, but you hear it all day, every day in the clubhouse, and it can be intimidating to go enter into a conversation with a bunch of guys not speaking your language, but that's how you really pick it up. On the flip side, we took a trip to the Dominican last year and randomly wound up getting in a meeting with the president of the country. We wound up, there were five of us sitting in the Oval Office, and our president, Derek Hall, promised him that we would put together the best education program for Dominican prospects in all of sports. And as we walked out of there, I said, I guess we got to go do that, huh? And he said, absolutely, we're doing it. And we just basically set up a program down there where every single one of our prospects now is getting a laptop and full. I mean, everybody's got an English language program down there. But this is, I think, we're taking it to another level where the majority of these kids are never actually even going to make it to the States, let alone to the major leagues. and we've now made a promise to the president of the country that we're going to teach them, we're going to educate them, because a lot of them are leaving the home at 13, 14 years old to go train with Busconis. So it's, there's no question that those who learn English, the players who have chosen to learn English, assimilate into the clubhouse better, are able to deal with the media better, are able to take instruction better from their coaches, but it's, you have to want it. You have to push yourself to do it.
Tyrone, this is a question for you too, Leo. Do you think that young players who speak English have an edge development-wise?
I think they do. I mean, I know as an organization, the Pirates organization has done a great job in the process of educating our young players. I got to give a big shout-out to Mayu Fielding, who works for us based in Florida, and she's our coordinator of our program. And she does a tremendous job of having our players get a good understanding and grasp of the language, of our language here. And you know, every year we have a graduation ceremony at our complex in the Dominican. And just from talking to her, just the pride that the players themselves have for this sense of accomplishment. And we understand, you know, obviously we're trying to develop players to potentially become major league players, but the end goal also was still at an aspect of trying to help them to grow and to be, you know, good citizens and understanding and having, you know, an English, you know, language ability to have so they can easily talk to teammates and also just have an idea of understanding things in their own country as well, just to give them that because of the lack of education in many cases. And, you know, our job, we feel like we have to do that, and we feel like it's something it helps them, definitely for sure, to be able to communicate easily with staff without any issues there by having that and just seeing them totally kind of speed up everything from that fact that they're actually learning a lot of different things.
Leo?
I would say that as Latin players, we have come a long way. I mean, it's been a long ride in baseball now. It's not anymore the 50s or the 60s where you got players that arrived directly to the U.S. from Venezuela or Dominican Republic or Puerto Rico or Mexico, and they just could say ham and eggs for 3 years, and we're like, hey, they were like, what's your name? Ham and eggs, like it was, you know, those horrible times or funny times, because stories are hilarious. You could spend hours telling stories about language barriers in a baseball clubhouse. But because of like what Josh was saying, the initiative that Major League Baseball teams have been taking for already 20 years, I would say, it's been two decades of constant education of players, learning English, you know, taking further steps, next level steps. It's been wonderful now. So players have been signed, a player who signed, 16 years old in the Dominican Republic or Venezuela or Colombia or whatever, goes to one of these state-of-the-art academies. They get to learn English in an early stage. By the time they're like 19 or 20, they already know like a good basic amount of English. They could communicate well. They could understand the coaching orders. They could understand the philosophy of the organization. They could, and when they come to the U.S., it's just now embracing the culture, which is a huge step forward than 40 or 50 years ago. And with the technology now, it's easier as well. Like now they have access, all of them, they have iPads, they have, you know, iPhones and Twitter, and they can, you know, they get access to all of these technology resources that makes it easier. So once they know, once they get into the U.S., they know everything, what's going on. They know, you know, they know the voices going on NBC, and they know, and they're aware of other things than baseball, and that helps ease the process of just going to the ballpark, getting along with the teammates, getting along with the coaching staff, and just really focus on baseball, focus on the field.
Leo, you mentioned players signing when they're 16. Let's consider this sort of a lightning round question, but Is 16 the right age? If we were starting all over, would it be 16? Would it be 16 in one country, 14 in other countries? I mean, I'm not going to ask why 16, because that's beyond the purview of us, but is 16 the right age to be signing these guys?
I would say that 16 is the right age to start with. If you sign a player with 16 years old and you spend that player on an average spends 2 or 3 years on an academy in another country, either in Dominican or Venezuela, and then comes to the U.S., the player comes here with, you know, to be on a rookie team where you're gonna have players with 20, 21, 22 years old coming out of, you know, the college. After 2 or 3 years of college, maybe, and they're pretty much at the same level, unless you have a couple of phenoms that, you know, they could go over. But, you know, in an average, that's pretty much the rule. So 16 is a good age. The setback of signing players at 16 years old in foreign countries has been that if you're 17 or 18 in the Dominican Republic or Venezuela, you're too old. So that's a setback for an amateur player. I mean, not all the players are the same. Not all the players are developed the same way. So maybe at 16 years old, you weren't good enough. Like maybe if you're a pitcher, 16 years old, your fastball is not as good as it might be when you're 18. So when the scouts saw you at 16 years old, maybe, you know, you were throwing 82 or 83, and then at 18 years old, after 2 years of hard work, you're probably reaching 90. So, but at 18 years old, you're not gonna get a bonus as high as you are if you're 16 or if you are like a high profile prospect. So that's a huge setback. There's been initiatives to help ease that. The Dominican Prospect League is one of them. So they're kind of like having players who can potentially sign at 18 years old.
Tyrone, is 16 the right number?
I believe 16 is an appropriate age. One, because you look at the player that does sign at age 16, in most cases they're not going to actually go out and play actually in the league that particular summer. So you're going to have now that developmental time to help that player. You got to remember the player itself, you know, in their background, where they're coming from, you know, some of these kids have not had great meals and opportunities as far mm-hmm. as nutrition. So we can now establish a routine with that player, understanding more about their body and physically, obviously what our strength staff in the Dominican are going to help them. We're going to help them at that point to try to understand more about their physical ability at that point. And our coaching staff are going to be there to obviously help them as far as the skill development and what they need. But also then you have the educational element as far as what we can do to kind of start that process. And at age 16, obviously we're all buying the potential of what that player can do at that point, but you have the aspect of where that player is in that developmental stage and just the lack of resources they've in most cases have had before that. And now we can provide an atmosphere to help them fully grow in every area and understanding who they are. And hopefully at the point, once we get through that process of that development now, have that opportunity to have them eventually hopefully make their way over to the United States, and having the chance to start that transition as early as we can at 16, I think really helps that.
So what's happening in Puerto Rico? There have been a lot of stories the last few years about the decrease in major leaguers coming from Puerto Rico, and that's been attributed by some people to the draft. Is the draft the issue, or is there something else going on?
You want to start?
Sure. Obviously it's, you know, Puerto Rico, obviously, you've seen a drop-off in the full numbers, how things were. But if you look at it, it's a situation. MLB right now has done a job recently, obviously, with the Puerto Rican Baseball Academy as a resource to kind of help. You know, the one thing I look at as far as what has hurt Puerto Rico is at the time when players could be signed at age 16, I mean, at that point, the incentive to go out and find those players was tremendous. Now with the draft, pretty much all those players are kind of lined up essentially for all the teams. Okay, this is the pool of players. And a lot of teams have really lost the incentive to really go out and really search farther on the island to find players. And by not having that incentive, I think there's players that have kind of slipped through the cracks in the whole process of as we go about scouting those players.
Yeah, the huge problem in Puerto Rico is that, you know, a high school in Puerto Rico or a college baseball program in Puerto Rico can never compete with a college or a high school program in the U.S. Resources are better here in the U.S. Facilities are better. There's a bunch of social and economical reasons. So players get affected by that. So you have a pool of very, very good, talented players in Puerto Rico competing against thousands, hundreds of thousands of amateur players in the U.S. into the same pool. So before 1990, teams were competing to go and scout in every single area in Puerto Rico. And they were able to find a lot of good talent there. Now there are teams that they don't have the need to go and scout. They just wait and see who's available in the draft. They have the Major League Academy, yes, but there's just like 30, 40 players per year, and then you're gonna have from those 30, 40 players maybe a top 10 who are really taking the spotlight. And then after those 10 players, I mean, those 10 players are really competing with 2,000 spotlight players in the United States.
So what you guys are saying is basically that there are players out there. It just doesn't make sense resource-wise for teams to spend a lot of time going and looking for them.
Right. It's strictly teams have fully just lost the whole incentive to really dig deep there.
If you take the Dominican, if the Dominican ever became subject to the draft, you would lose essentially. Well, I mean, you have tons of Buscones who are out there finding kids at 11, 12 years old, spending 4 and 5 years developing them, and because their bonus is going to be significantly larger because they've got 30
exactly.
teams that are all bidding on the same services. So when you basically take away that incentive of development, of finding the kid who's 11 who's well above everybody else, and then turning them into this monster like Sano and getting $4 million for them when they're 16, that can't happen in Puerto Rico just based on the system.
So in Puerto Rico, you don't have the hyper-sophisticated development system for very young players that we have here, or the Busconi system in the Dominican Republic. That's basically the issue. There's no, you have neither of these development systems.
I think one thing is when you have a free market like you have in the Dominican, you're providing incentive for those that are helping to train those players.
Right.
Because they realize there's a future payout that's going to be there for a chance for a kid to have that opportunity to sign.
And pretty much in Puerto Rico, you're having the Little League system. So if you want to play baseball since you're a kid, then you go to Little League. And then after Little Leagues, you enroll into a baseball program, whether it's in your high school or in a college. But programs are really limited. I mean, there's just a handful. I mean, there's probably, I wouldn't say 50, 60 in the whole island. So those 50 or 60 programs are competing with 1,000 programs in the U.S. And so everything is getting into the same pool. And that has affected the amount of fans and the amount of attention of baseball in Puerto Rico, because the less big stars or the less amount of players from Puerto Rico are drawing, I mean, it's drawing less attention from in the island inside. So the Winter League has been affected because of that. The attendance in the Winter League has affected because of that. The business of baseball has been affected because of that. It's pretty much a big problem. For them, it was huge to reach the finals in the World Baseball Classic, and they hope that with that and with performance in international stages like Caribbean Series and other tournaments, they're hoping to bring back the attention of baseball in Puerto Rico.
Take some questions now. Have the mics.
Thank you. Major League Baseball opened the League Academy in the Dominican in 1985, and then maybe 10 years later, I think in 2003, the Red Sox opened their own academy. At this point, every team has an academy. There's an affiliated league there, the Dominican Summer League. And I wonder, is that the model in other emerging markets? I mean, the Major League Baseball opened an academy in Australia in 2001, and the academy in China in 2007. Will we start to see some team-level involvement in either of those countries at any point in the near future?
Tyrone?
I think definitely. That's something that model is something that we're you know, obviously even now trying to incorporate here in the United States with the different urban academies that are being put in place here. Just the idea, here's an opportunity to pull some resources together in this particular country, see where we can start to build a foundation there and to continue to grow it from that point. I think you're going to continue to see that in various markets once you're really trying to find the next frontier of areas.
I think from an overhead standpoint, though, it costs a good amount of money to operate an academy in a country. And so there's a lot of people who have their Dominican academy, but that's where they send kids from Venezuela. It's where they send kids from Mexico. And that may be the model still for a little while just because it's not cheap to build a brand new academy for a team in Australia until there is 75, 80 kids per franchise operating there, and then it becomes worth your while.
Josh, do you know how much it costs to operate an academy?
It's in seven figures when you start talking about to operate it. No, I take that back. To operate it, no, I couldn't give you an exact figure, but certainly to build it. I mean, you look at what the Padres built out there. I think did you guys build recently or not?
Yeah, we built the place in the Dominican, which is everybody has kind of used it almost as sort of a model. A lot of the new ones that have been built here recently in the last couple of years.
These are not cheap to build, and then to have the coaches and the staff and the food and the wait. I mean, we just put $500,000 into renovations at our place within the past 2 years, and it still doesn't even remotely compare to what people have in the United States when it comes to prospect training. So it is definitely not a cheap endeavor.
I think everybody realizes now to be able to compete over there, you have to have a place. Everybody's looking at the next. Hey, this academy, I look at what they've done here, and everybody's kind of feeding off of that in this whole competition for players.
Well, based on team reports, for example, to provide an example, the Mariners just opened an academy recently, like a month ago, in the Dominican Republic, and the whole the cost was $4.2 million. The annual operating cost, it's around $2 or $3 million. For teams to make a huge investment in the Dominican Republic, that says that the future will be that the Dominican Republic will be the satellite of Major League Baseball outside the U.S. And they can bring prospects all around the world into the Dominican Republic. With the increasing situation of problems in Venezuela, economical instability, the government issues that are happening right there, teams are leaving Venezuela and now they're basing their operations outside the U.S. more into the Dominican Republic. And to answer your question, why Venezuela, what was the big boom with Venezuelan players? That's the reason. In 1989, the Astros opened an academy, opened the first academy in Venezuela by an initiative from Andres Reiner, longtime scout from the Astros. And he convinced the Astros to start an academy in Venezuela, just like the ones in the Dominican Republic. And that academy was so successful that other teams started to follow up. And at one point, there were about 18 teams operating in Venezuela with either their own academies or operating a field with staff as some sort of a semi-academy. But they've taken in the Dominican Republic, they took it to the next level, building their own facilities, having good relationship with the local government, and fully operating as a Dominican Republic entity and company.
You know, what you said makes a good point as far as even when we decided to go about building our facility in the Dominican, and we had an operation in Venezuela at that time, but we realized as far as having a real central hub for what we can do in Latin America, we had to have everything really centralized there in order for us to really optimize what we can do from our staff and really to help the players in the best way.
So you bring players from Venezuela over to your academy?
Yeah, even Mexico.
Do they live there all year round, or do they go back home in the off-season?
I mean, they're there for much of the year for with the training that's going on and, you know, even an instructional league that we do there as well. I mean, they're there a good portion, and that's why having, you know, a facility where the players are going to also feel comfortable as far as having an environment where they can learn both on the field and off is so important.
Yep.
What steps need to be taken to make the Latin American process more equitable to both teams and players? And has the CBA, the new CBA, been a step in the right direction for that?
What was the question?
Sorry, I'm not sure. I'm not sure we got that.
Yeah.
So the question is, what steps need to be taken in the Latin American signing process to be make it more fair to both teams in the small market and larger markets, and also to the players who have to sign with these teams?
Let me follow up on that. I should have asked earlier about the impact of the new signing rules and bonus rules, and I think that sort of folds in with his question. You can follow up on that.
I mean, the process of now how everything is set up now with the CBA and at least how the new international signings, the bonus, you know, allotments that we have now, I mean, they're trying to make that so it's fair for everybody based upon, you know, obviously the previous year's finish. So obviously a team that finishes with a better record is going to be at the lower end of the spectrum as far as having the dollars available, trying to make sure that money is being shifted to those teams that do have a need as far as having players to develop. I mean, it's definitely changed the whole landscape of everything as far as having that ability to knowing, you know, having basically unlimited amounts of money which you could have available to do what you wanted to do. As far as, you know, a few years ago we signed Luis Heredia for $3 million, and now our total allotment we have as an organization is not even that amount because of the way things are now. So, I mean, something we obviously just have to adapt to, and obviously each team now has to just make their choices on where they can invest their money. Obviously, we're seeing a few other organizations now are trying to maybe not circumvent the rules, but they're finding ways to do things as far as, hey, we're going to blow it out this year. We're going to sign all these particular players now, but then obviously we're going to incur, you know, some penalties here the following year just because of the fact that we can't do anything that time, now in 2015 but now we're going to do what we can here in 14 at this point.
And it's a delicate balance to your question about what fair for who. I mean, if you're talking about fair for the 30 major league teams, then just have an international draft and call it a day and we can all go get the same talent. But is that fair to the entire industry of baseball in Dominican Republic where people's families depend on the money that comes in at a higher level? I mean, there's different views of the word fair, I would say.
Leo, what are the new rules done for the players?
I think it's just, I think in that area, it's just the owners don't want to step on each other's tails. It's just they're just trying to keep it safe for the business and not to you know, to come up with, you know, with huge expenses and, you know, and teams taking advantage of the international market. And just trying to limit the amount of money that they can put into the international signings. And on the other hand, it's just they haven't limited the money that will be spent into the U.S. draft. So in other terms, like, you can give X amount of money to a first pick in the draft, but now you can't give the X amount of money to your top international prospect. So it can be seen kind of unfair, but at the same time, if they think it's good for the business, I think it is. So
you haven't seen any drop in the interest among young players in the Dominican or Venezuela?
No, not at all. I mean, let's remember that it's a ridiculous, huge amount of money. It's ridiculous. I mean, you're telling a kid who's living in a really, really, really extreme poor area, hey, we're going to give you $500,000. That will, I would, they will kill for that. Oh, that's outrageous.
And if it goes to $400,000, it's not going to change anything.
And then is, and you know, a few years ago it was like, you know what, your son might have a good chance of making a $2 million bonus. These days could be like, hey, your son could be making an $800,000 bonus. For them, it's just a huge amount of money. I mean, they're going to buy 7 houses for all the family. They're going to buy Hummers for all the cousins and the cousins of the cousins. They're going to put, you know, they're going to build a new church in the town. They're going to, you know, they're going to open a, they're going to put stands into the local ballpark. It's a lot of money. They just got to be, you know, teams are being very, very good in trying to advise these players what to do with the money, especially with kids with huge bonuses. And at the same time, it's really a challenge for teams on, like this guy, Luis Heredia, how can you crystallize your investment? I mean, you're giving $3 million to a kid. You really want that kid to shine in the majors. He's all for shining in the majors. How can you make it shine? What is going to be the ideal process for that player to get into right track to the majors and make your investment worthy? And sometimes it doesn't happen, unfortunately, for teams.
We have time for two more, I think, if we keep it short. Yeah, back here.
This is kind of related to what you just said, but basically for any amateur player who enters Major League Baseball from anywhere, from my understanding of all the systems involved, there seem to exist two double standards. The first one is among those from the US, Canada, Puerto Rico, and those in the international market. All these 16-year-olds in the international market basically get to choose wherever they want to go, and they can start getting developed by major league teams from age 16, whereas those in the US, Canada, and Puerto Rico, they are not getting paid until at the very minimum 18 years old, where they still have to finish high school and then possibly go to college. The second one exists in the international market itself, where the players from Latin America and Taiwan, for instance, can go into the minor league systems at age 16 and start getting developed there, whereas those from, say, Korea and Japan have to go through the professional leagues there. We saw Tozawa a few years ago when he signed with the Red Sox as an amateur. The entire country of Japan went up in arms because of that. And then last year, or 2 years ago, we saw Kim Sung-min from the KBO get signed at age 17 by the Orioles, and the MLB ended up voiding that contract because...
I'm losing the thread. Can we boil it down to a question?
So my question basically is that, do you see an international draft coming in? And if so, for these players from Korea and Japan, do you see a system similar to the NBA where you can sign or you can draft the players as amateurs from these countries, and these teams can hold their rights for X number of years before they get signed?
Tyrone?
I mean, I think the way the system is set up, it's just so difficult to try to have something in place. As you know, there's been so much talk about an idea of an international type draft, and it's just, there's so many little elements of that which would be difficult to put together. And I think that the current structure, the way it's set up now, is just going to continue at this stage. I think right now it's just too difficult at this point to do something there. So you're going to have the same situation as far as, you know, internationally, what you're able to do in Latin America. And obviously, you know, with the posting system that's in place in Asia, you're going to just continue to see that. Obviously, we saw changes to the posting system here recently, and now that, you know, 20 million is the max that a team would actually play. Now it's leveling the playing field in that realm. Obviously, the owners in Japan and all that are probably not happy about that to some degree, because, you know, they had a chance to really have a viable player that they can really make a boatload of money there on that player. But, you know, at this point, I think it's just going to continue with the way the system is.
I agree. And to add a little bit on that, I think it's gonna stay the same, because you're fighting against a tradition of how baseball is played and structured around the world. In Korea and Japan and Asian countries, players, there's professional leagues that play in the summer, and they, as part of their rules, players have to be have to sign first with a local team, and then that team have to sign have to either sell the player, just like soccer, sell the players, or you know, or make a deal with an MLB team or with an international team to allow them to play. In Latin America, it's different. So it is, you know, if
one size doesn't fit all.
Or not,
yeah. I mean, you got all these different federations involved, and they have their own interest in everything, and they want to make sure the game is being presented the right way in their particular countries,
right,
and that their fans are first and foremost being taken care of.
One more quick one. Yep.
Could someone explain the role of buscones today, and specifically whether or not there are some organization regulating them and trying to protect the players from exploitation?
Great question. Leo?
The role for buscones. Oh, the buscones. The buscones are really a scout. I mean, a buscone is a scout, really. I mean, sometimes are affiliated with teams, and sometimes they're not. And sometimes a scout in a certain country might have a friend who is referring players to him, which is the real buscón. The problem with that's not really the problem. The problem is that when you have a major league scout in the Dominican Republic, that has happened a lot, and that's where everything exploited. When you have a scout and you have a couple of guys or person who told you, who are referring you a player, and they all want a cut of the bonus of the kid. So that's illegal under MLB rules. That's illegal under in the Dominican, that's against the law in the Dominican Republic as well. And they have established a percentage, which right now is 25%. In reality, they don't respect that. In reality, you can say, like, yes, the MLB check of the bonus, like, you sign a kid for $1 million, so $750 is going to the player, and then $250,000 are going to the buscón or the agent per se. That agent keeps the money. But if they make deals with the family and say, like, hey, I'm going to find you a deal with the Pittsburgh Pirates, and you're going to have to give me half of it, and you agreed on that, that's a private thing. That's, you can't really control that. What MLB can do is just follow the rules and just try to put the money in the correct hands, and whatever happens with the money after that, that's pretty much up to the player, the family, and whoever signed the contract, right?
Yeah. I mean, even now, in the process, when teams are signing players, and they're also, MLB has recently done a lot more showcases trying to present the players that are out there, and they fully acknowledge who the trainer is that's involved in that particular player. So it's something that's very, very publicized at this point.
That'll do it. That's a tremendous subject. I hope we can do it again next year. Until then, thanks to the panel.